Welcome to The Wagon, presented by Sport Clips, the official podcast of the Canadian Football League.
Welcome, welcome, welcome once again to another edition of the Waggle Podcast, which is brought to you by our friends at Sport Clips, who are known for their Sport Clips MVP haircut experience, which includes shampoos massaged right into your scalp, hot steam towels for your face, and sports on TV like, for example, hockey, baseball, and basketball. But we know the most important sport, the sport you love, the sport I love, football on those TVs. Oh, right, and legendary haircuts. It's good to be a guy, it's good to be a Sport Clips guy, and it's good to be a CFL fan this week. I mean, certainly it's good to be a CFL fan all of the time, but we've got some coverage for you. Our Grey Cup Unite coverage is off and running. Make sure you go to our website and consume as much as you possibly can virtually, as if you're like me. It's been pretty fun to see different interactions with fans and our great players. It's as close we can get to a Grey Cup week without a Grey Cup this year. And I apologize for this being a little bit late coming out this week. It's because we were waiting for our all-decade team to be announced. It's the first time we've done this. It's presented to you by Leo Vegas. And that's what this podcast is going to be about. We're going to react to the first team and second team of the greatest players over the last 10 years with a great player himself. Dwayne Ford joins us. That conversation up next on The Waggle. So when it comes to breaking down, analyzing Canadian players, no better to pick the brain of a man who probably deadlifts the same weight this decade as he did when he played. And so if you've shaken his hand, you probably think that he could still play in this decade. But he was a great player. I won't say which decade, but a couple decades ago. Dwayne Ford joins us. Thank you so much, D Ford, for going through this list. And it's basically, you know, the ability to put together a CFL fantasy team because there are so many great names. There's a couple of, I guess, narratives that jump out to me that I'd love to unpack with you. And for our listeners, feel free to go to CFL.ca to see the full list. First team, second team. If we don't mention your favorite player, like, don't at me. Just go on CFL.ca and check out the list. I want to start with the position that we love. To me, you know, arguably the most, it's not athletic, well-rounded players on the field. Of course, God's favorite position, the running back position. And the thing that jumped out at me when I was looking at the list of players, and lots of great ones, but to me, by far and away, the best choices at this position were Canadians. And I don't think other than like the early times of the league, but in recent memory, the modern day CFL, I don't think you could find another 10-year allotment of time where you could say that by and large, tailback specifically, the best players were Canadian. And for those who haven't seen the list, first team is Andrew Harris, who's still playing at a high level. John Cornish is the second team, but even a guy who didn't, you know, make the two spots. When you look at someone, if we're looking at their peak performance, Jerome Messam would be in that conversation. I love to see that trend, and I think it's a sign of the change in the league over the last 10 years. What are your thoughts when you see those names beside first team and second team all decade?
Yeah, I think that you're bang on when you talk about the trend in football. The number one thing is that you're seeing it. There's obviously the big boom in terms of NCAA football right now, but even U Sports football, in terms of the level of talent and depth of talent of Canadians at skill positions is greater than it has ever been. And so those guys are getting more and more opportunities, and I think you're going to see more and more opportunities for Canadians at skill positions going forward in the CFL. You know, Andrew Harris, John Cornish, Jerome Messam. Yeah, those guys were a huge part of that at the running back position over the course of the last decade, and changing the way that people think, the way that people view Canadians as a possibility to play that spot. You know, one other thing that I will throw in, though, from, I guess, that analytical point of view, when you look at those maybe being three of the guys that you would talk about most at the running back position over the last decade, is understanding the difference in ratio dynamics in the Canadian Football League, and understanding that when you look at an all-decade team, a Canadian running back isn't as, quite frankly, replaceable as an American running back, right? We've talked about this in the past, that American running backs, just because of supply and demand, quite frankly, it's, you know, it's sort of one of the most replaceable positions in football in general, but particularly in the Canadian Football League, where typically you only need one American running back per team. And so by virtue of being Canadian, there's a little bit more job security there afforded guys like Andrew Harris and John Cornish that, you know, that I think when you look at an all-decade team, contributes to their longevity a little bit. Obviously, highly productive guys, outstanding players, guys you talk about as most outstanding player in the league, regardless of their birth certificates. But there are some dynamics there for them because they are Canadian that are different than what they would be if they were American.
Yeah, interesting for me looking at this list, because many of these guys, in terms of coming up, are my peers in terms of age, either around my age or probably younger. And when we were coming up, thinking of the great running backs, and for those who don't know, Dwayne is a savant about like finding some kid in grade 10 at a small school who's killing it, who you know, could be a CFL player, or more often finding some kid who spent summers here for like 5 years, but really is American and could qualify as a Canadian in the CFL. But some of the names when I was young, in terms of Canadian running backs, because when I was young, you never really thought you could be a starting feature tailback like these guys are. If you asked me, who would be that person that would change it? I would say maybe Clifton Dawson or Mike Labinjo, who was a tailback in high school, yeah. Or Jesse Lumsden, St. Mike's, or Nick Wishart, or after that, Tyler Varga. And it's not any of these guys. Now, some of those guys, and Jesse Lumsden, some of those guys went on to play professionally at different positions, or play. Varga and Clifton Dawson had stints in the NFL. But maybe Cornish, because he was just a game wrecker on special teams, so athletically, you thought, for sure. But Andrew Harris certainly had a different route. And I love the fact that these guys, you know, maybe not the names I would have chosen, you know, when I was 14 or 15 or 16 at a Ron Dias football camp, but these guys ended up being there. Let's transition, though, to receiver, because I do see some commonalities in the group of receivers. And so the first teams, S.J. Green, Adarius Bowman, Weston Dressler, Manny Arsenault, Nick Lewis. Second team, Greg Ellingson, Brandon Banks, Fred Stamps, Brian Burnham, Darrell Walker. No Canadians there. Does that surprise you? And two, if we're doing an all-decade team, you know, 10 years from now, do you think that's different or still the case?
Yeah, I certainly do, you know, unless, quite frankly, too many of the top receivers that are out there end up playing south of the border. But I, you know, going back to what we talked about with the running backs, I do think that there's a significant wave, right, of Canadian skill guys. And, you know, as you know, I look at a lot of things going back from that draft perspective in terms of where we're at with Canadian talent. And It used to be that when you would look at a draft list, that the majority of the Division I players that you would see on a CFL draft list, so basically the majority of Canadians playing at Division I schools and contributing at Division I schools, would be linemen, especially offensive linemen, guys who had been recruited largely because of their size. And what we're really seeing now is more and more of those skill guys, more and more Canadian players. There's a huge wave of very good Canadian receivers. Chase Claypool, of course, in the NFL is kind of at the front edge of that. But a number of outstanding guys that'll be coming out of college football in the next few years, and whether they end up in the National Football League or the Canadian Football League, time will tell. But you know, much like with the running backs, you've got a wave of skill guys coming at other positions that are maybe a little bit less traditional for Canadians: receivers, defensive backs, and so on. That, yeah, I think when
you know, when we're having this conversation in the year 2030, that, yeah, I would think that you might see some Canadian names that are seeing response.
So for a long time, outside of some exceptional cases, a guy like Clairmont or Sapungis, the Canadian receiver on the field was like your fifth receiver out wide, often running routes for exercise. A guy who had to know all the positions in case there's an injury and had to fill in spot. Now you're seeing like more in waves that like, no, your second, your third read on a lot of teams are guys that are Canadian. Are there any guys coming up who you say, you know what, that guy for the balance of his career could be a number one receiver, someone who would dictate coverage and someone who game plans would be around?
Yeah, probably one of the more intriguing guys to me in that regard would be Tavon Smith in Edmonton. That he had times last year where he had some big games, and particularly as he kind of got settled in and readjusted to the Canadian game. You're talking about a guy who hadn't played Canadian football since probably grade 11 or 12 as he finished his high school career down south, played at University of Iowa, and kind of bounced around the NFL for a couple of years. But he's one of those guys that I think, yeah, you could see him grow into a bigger role over the course of his career, and particularly playing in an offensive scheme as they tend to run in Edmonton. You know, that may change slightly going forward, but where they're going to move people around, everybody's going to get opportunities to get touches. The ball is going to be spread around, but it's, you know, as good as Greg Ellingson is, you know, as good as Ricky Collins was for them last year, that you're going to see, I guess, a little bit more balance in terms of the targets in that offense. And Tavon Smith is a guy who could benefit from that.
No surprise there are Canadians across the offensive line on the first team and second team. I'd love to see that there are some U Sports products in that mix as well. But I really struggle with offensive line when it comes to things like all-star teams or things like this, all-decade teams, because ultimately, like, unless you're watching film and you see how often you know that offensive lineman, you know, gets to the second level or how often they take upper steps, do you really know? There are no stats. I feel like defensive line coaches should be the only people who vote on offensive line, because they can tell who's doing it the best. And ultimately, we hear offensive linemen's names more often when they give up a sack, more than when they're having a dominant performance. The guards, and this is almost a philosophical question. You've got Labatt and Bombin as the first team. You've got Fleury and O'Donnell as second team. When you approach something like this, is it more of who had the body of work across the time period in this, you know, obviously the 10 years, or who at the highest level was the most dominant player?
Yeah, and I think that with an all-decade team, it becomes a little bit more of a body of work. And guard is a great example of a position to look at, because I think when you look at this group of guys, for me, Scott Fleury is the best player of the group and the guy who has had the best career to date. And that's not taking anything away from the other guys. Scott Fleury is in the Hall of Fame and was an easy selection to go into the Hall of Fame. So it's taking nothing away from the other guys. You know, Scott Fleury is an outstanding player, perennial all-star throughout his career, but obviously a lot of his career took place in the previous decade, not as much between 2010 and 2020. And so with an all-decade team, I would think that that's something that hurts him a little bit in terms of the ballot like this. Whereas, for example, you've got a guy like Brendan Labatt, again, outstanding player, maybe a future Hall of Famer. I think that seems fairly likely for Labatt. So similar kind of player, but a guy who came into the league in 2008 and so played the entire decade that we're talking about here. And so that becomes an advantage for him when you talk about that body of work.
Let's go to specials and give those guys some love. You know, I love that there's a New Brunswick native on the list, Mike Miller, who actually went undrafted out of his U Sports career coming out of Acadia, and was a dominant player. He's first team. And then Jason Araki, who was dominant as a U Sports player as well. Both guys who are great examples of it's not necessarily where you start or where you play, but you can find a role and play for a long time and be really, really valuable to your club if you are, you know, a demon on special teams. What sticks out to you about those two names?
Yeah, both those guys are guys who people maybe looked at measurables coming out of college and so on, and may have looked at them a little bit as guys, particularly Mike Miller, who didn't really have a position on defense. Mike Miller was a guy who was an outstanding defensive back in university at Acadia. You know, people didn't necessarily see him that high on the depth chart as a defensive back, but through sheer effort. And I would say a similar thing about Jason Araki, maybe a little bit of a tweener coming out of McMaster, a guy who's a linebacker, but you know, not the biggest guy to be playing that position. And, you know, two guys who I would say kind of demonstrate that when it comes to special teams, where it is very much about will, about being hard-nosed, a willingness to do the dirty work, understanding your assignments, taking on challenges. When your guys who have been as productive as special teams cover guys as those guys have been over the course of your careers, you're going to draw the other team's best special teams players as well, as people attempting to block you. You're going to draw double teams and so on, no different than if you were playing defense. And these are guys who continued to produce regardless of that. And you know, in the Canadian Football League, where you're talking about three down football, those guys can be playing as many snaps as starters on offense or defense and become every bit as valuable in terms of what they do.
The guys who touch the ball the most on offense, outside of the centers, obviously the quarterbacks, and that naturally was going to be one that was hotly contested, and lots of good names. I mean, in any generation, there's obviously a bunch of good quarterbacks, but there's a bunch of Hall of Famers in this generation. Bo Levi Mitchell went 77-18 in the decade, 804 winning percentage. He is your first team quarterback. Some high profile, obviously, losses in Grey Cups, but obviously was on the most dominant team for the decade. And then Ricky Ray is the second teamer who obviously wrapped up his career and retired this decade. There's lots of names to choose from. Anthony Calvillo is one. Henry Burris, certainly. Mike Riley. You know, if you're just looking at the numbers, Trevor Harris put up outstanding numbers. Are these two guys slotted correctly for you? I actually would have, you know, not that anyone cares what I think, but I actually would have had Ricky Ray first, only because I think he's he can make an argument. He was like the most important player for multiple franchises and played great in big games. But certainly Bo has great numbers. Are these two guys slotted for you correctly? 1-2?
Yeah, this is a challenging one for me. I think that, you know, I mean, you mentioned some of the other names that would have been very much in the mix when you talk about this position. Henry Burris, you know, a Hall of Fame career, finishes his career with a Grey Cup, you know, prior to Bo Levi Mitchell, with some others in between, you know, was a guy who led that sort of flagship franchise in Calgary and had them as a very good team, a perennial contender at that time, put up monster numbers over the course of a brief time, couple of seasons in Hamilton, and then obviously starting from scratch with an expansion franchise in Ottawa and turned that team into Grey Cup finalists and eventually Grey Cup winners starting from ground zero. So I think that's a pretty impressive body of work. You know, Mike Riley, what he did in Edmonton isn't all that dissimilar when you talk about where Edmonton started off when Mike Riley arrived there versus where they ended up. A couple of tough seasons, that first season in Edmonton for him, and a bit of a rough season in 2019 in BC. But I mean, for me, Mike Riley has become one of the absolute faces of the Canadian Football League over the course of the last decade. So it's tough to see those guys on the outside, but having said that, yeah, hard to argue with Bo Levi Mitchell as the first team guy. You talked about that winning percentage, which is what I think it ultimately comes down to for quarterbacks, you know, quarterback on the most successful team in the league during that time. He has been a most outstanding player and very deservedly so. So I think that he's probably the easier one as the first team. Ricky Ray in the second team, there may be a little bit more debate, and that's saying something given the career that Ricky Ray had, a Grey Cup champion with a couple of teams, career passing leader with a couple of different franchises, remarkable career. And it speaks to the quality of quarterbacking that Canadian Football League fans have been treated to over the course of the last 10 years.
Yeah. And a lot of that is due to, you know, the stability in, you know, the situations that he was in. And when you think of stability, there's no greater example of that than, you know, Calgary where you played, and, you know, two guys, who were up really for coach of the decade are guys, you know, well, you know, John Hafnagel winning 79 games, in a Grey Cup, in his six seasons, leading the Stamps as head coach, is the choice as the coach to lead these 29 players. And then the runner up is his understudy, Dave Dickinson, who, you know, didn't really miss a beat when he took over for John since then. It's funny because when we talk about Bo, Bo's 30. Like, I think there's a real case that he could be the QB of the decade, you know, moving forward, given the fact that quarterbacks are playing longer and longer. I say the same.
Ricky Ray's appearance on this list speaks to that, right? Because I think Ricky Ray would be very much in the middle of that conversation if you did an all-decade team for the previous decade.
Right, yeah. And I think, you know, similarly, so Dave Dickinson is runner-up to John Hufnagel. I could foresee a situation where Dave Dickinson is the head coach of the all-decade team when we're doing this, you know, 10 years from now. Huff and Dave, you know, those two names on this list, what stands out to you about those names?
Well, for me, and obviously given my own history in the league, John Hufnagel is a guy who was my offensive coordinator for a few years during his time on Wally Buono's coaching staff in Calgary. And Dave Dickinson, one of my former teammates, who wasn't only in coaches meetings in more recent years with John Hufnagel, but would have been John's last year as the offensive coordinator in Calgary was actually Dave's rookie season, 1996. And so, you know, that's a history that goes back a long way. But you combine the presence of those two guys on that list with Bo Levi Mitchell as the quarterback, first team quarterback on this list. Don't want to overlook Ryan Dinwiddie, who had been the quarterback coach in Calgary for a number of years before becoming the Toronto Argonauts head coach. We talked about Henry Burris, another guy who started his career in Calgary, had been under John Hufnagel, teammates with Dave Dickinson and so on for a number of years. You talk about the strength and knowledge and coaching at the quarterback position and kind of understand that the success of that franchise is very much tied to the quarterback position.
Yeah, that's a good point. I actually didn't even think about, I forgot about Dinwiddie already, even though it's been a while since he hasn't been in that situation. He hasn't really coached a game yet for the Argonauts. But yeah, that tree is continuing to get bigger and bigger. So as we move forward, because we haven't been able, sadly, to watch any CFL football in the recent months, but you mentioned it, and I want to circle back. We have seen in the football that we've watched, both NCAA and NFL, an explosion of Canadians, not just playing, but playing really well. And even if you want to expand that to, players who are CFL alums, like Alex Singleton, when he got his opportunity, he's being a star in his role, which is a dynamic that, again, would have been different from, you know, if we did this 10 years ago or 20 years ago. You know, what Well, if there's one thing that you could kind of put your finger on why we're seeing, you know, I see it on my Instagram feed almost every Sunday, photos of NFL games with like 4, 5, 6 Canadians taking a photo after games are over. If you could put your finger on why you think that's happening specifically now, what would it be?
Probably a combination of things for me. One of them is obviously that as guys have gone down there and have had success, it creates an awareness from American scouts, NFL scouts, you know, at an earlier stage, NCAA scouts, that there's very much of an awareness that there's a lot of talent here in Canada. And so there are guys getting opportunities as a result of that. You know, if you kind of talk about over the last, say, 15 years, maybe 20 years, just in general, the world getting a little bit smaller, things like the internet that I think have had a couple of impacts. One of those is obviously that it becomes easier for people to be found in so many, you know, people with various talents, right? Like we've seen it in the music industry where people are kind of discovered on internet. But I would say football is no different, where you can get game film to any coach, and a coach has an opportunity to see any player in any part of the world play because of the internet, because of, you know, email, because of various recruiting sites where guys can post highlights, because of YouTube and so on. So that's a factor in it. But one of the biggest things to me, very specifically in football, has been more and more over the last decade, is Canadian guys recognizing what needs to be done to put themselves in the best possible position to compete with American players. And so whether that is, you know, sort of getting out of your small town and getting to camps to compete against other high level players, sometimes it's going down to the States for high schools. Sometimes it's going to the States for recruiting camps and things like that. But again, a lot of times it's even taking opportunities in Canada to take part in best on best competition that I think is helping to, you know, sort of strengthen our talent base here. And as you said, like you're seeing the fruits of that on Saturday and Sunday afternoons south of the border.
So as we know, COVID-19 and, you know, whatever our new normal ends up being, it's going to impact our lives in all different ways, all different industries. People have to pivot to react. And I am somewhat fascinated, even though it's, you know, inconsequential relative to a lot of other things going on, I'm fascinated to see what the impact is on the recruitment and research and development and drafting of football players. We may have somewhat of a double cohort of a class. We may have a situation where a bunch of players haven't played football for a while, but also from a CFL perspective, you may have a season where you don't know what your team needs are because your team didn't play. So how you fill out your roster will be somewhat fascinating. I we've talked about this before. I think specifically being a CFL general manager executive is the most difficult executive job in sports. You got to look at all different leagues and types of players and players at different ages, and you're dealing with, you know, smaller margins in terms of finances. What is this pause and period going to do to the scouting and development and drafting of players moving forward?
Yeah, I think in terms of the way the job is done, I think you're actually going to see some positives come out of it, because even the 2020 draft, we experienced this because there were essentially no combines and limited pro days and things like that. A lot of those things happened virtually. Scouts, general managers, personnel people were forced to be a little more resourceful, forced to rely on other tools and different avenues to evaluate players. And I think ultimately what it will do is make the process of evaluating players more thorough than it has ever been, because there will come a time, obviously, where we would anticipate getting back to combines and pro days and things like that. But recognizing that all of these other resources are out there, taking the time to talk to college coaches, spending a little bit more time watching game film and, you know, I mean, things that scouts have done, but putting more time into doing those things and, you know, and quite frankly, maybe putting a little bit less weight on things like combines and greater weight on a kid's body of work over the course of his career. You know, putting more stock in the things said by people who have coached them and played with them before and so on. But yeah, bottom line, I think that it's going to be better for the process, because I think it's forcing everybody in the industry to become more thorough in the way that they evaluate players.
I love that, because you answered like two of my questions in one, because just as you're saying that, I was thinking, and I'm fully immersed in NBA draft prep now and covering some of the prospects and talking to evaluators. There's been a shift where it's less about measurables and athleticism, and it's more about intangibles. How competitive is the player? How accountable are they? How willing are they to sacrifice? Unless, you know, what's their standing broad jump or their wingspan? Are you saying you probably, because of a lack of ability in some of those testing numbers, that you'll see a shift in terms of, you know, okay, well, what type of person are we bringing into our building? Not so much what type of athlete are we bringing into our building?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. It's one of the fascinating things to me about sports, and football is probably at the top of the list in this, is that change doesn't come easily, right? People kind of like to do things a certain way for no reason other than that's how they've always done them. And it's been said about the Canadian Football League, and as much as we all love the league, I think you've got a league where its history is both one of its greatest assets, but also one of its greatest obstacles, is kind of getting past, the way things have previously been done. And, so in that regard, I think that you slowly will start to see some change in where the weight is placed in terms of the evaluations. But, you know, I think that the teams that have been most successful will tell you that they have always spent a little bit of time evaluating the character of people and making sure that they're going to be a fit with their team as part of their decision-making process on final rosters, at least.
Well, whether that change happens slow or fast, whether we're talking about players of the past, the all-decade team, or the players of the future coming into the league via the draft, you're the guy to break it down for us. Your acumen is really appreciated. Thank you once again, Dee Ford.
My pleasure, Mr. Bennett. Anytime, sir.
Man, I could listen to Dwayne Ford talk about football forever. I mean, I could listen to him in that voice do anything. He could read the phone book to me and I would listen to it. And I know that's the case specifically for our fans and our listeners in Calgary. He's still one of the most beloved Stampeders because he won big time and was a Grey Cup champ with the Stamps. Speaking of Grey Cup champs, especially in that province of Alberta, let's go from the Stamps to Edmonton. Since this is Grey Cup Unite Week, and we are celebrating all things Grey Cup, we figured it was only fitting to have Hugh Campbell on, the architect of the Edmonton teams that won 5 in a row. He himself has 10 Grey Cup rings in his possession. He's won as a player, as a coach, as an executive. And you've seen on our website, we've been revisiting great teams in general, and great memories with our remote reunions driven by Kubota. And on this very podcast, we have revisited those remote reunions driven by Kubota. And so who else on this week to talk to than the man himself, Hugh Campbell?
For 107 years, every Grey Cup moment has included you. the fan. This is your league. Through fog and rain, in tragedy and triumph, you are the foundation of this league. Now take your place in history. For a limited time, you can etch your name on the Grey Cup fan base. Become a part of the Grey Cup's legacy. Visit greycupfanbase.ca to add your name and raise the cup.
So Hugh, you are famous for being the architect for, you know, maybe the most dominant stretch of football in the Canadian Football League. We've seen your teams in the 80s are standard bearers, and obviously the star of that team being, you know, Hall of Famer and multiple Hall of Fames, Warren Moon. What do you remember about the time in the league, but the time specifically in Edmonton when you guys really became, you know, a big part of the City of Champions?
Well, I think it was a great time. It was fun. As it was happening, you know, the league was very well balanced. I mean, during that time, we played every team in the league almost consecutively. There was one interruption, but with the playoffs and the Grey Cup, there was a time there that in playoff games, we played almost every single team that, and I don't want to hurt any feelings, but Saskatchewan was the only team that we never played in a playoff game during that stretch. And there were some really good coaches in the league. And so it was a time of very evenly matched football. And so you had to be up every week. You had to be at your best in order to be competitive. And we went, I don't know, I think it was 5 years or something. During that six-year period, I think it was a five-year period where we never lost a game by more than 10 points. And we had a few blowouts, but most of our wins were relatively close to. And it was week after week having to play your best football. And the Warren Moon is an all-time player. But before Warren came, we had Bruce Lemmerman, who took us to the and played the Grey Cup in 77. And then we had Tom Wilkinson, who got us a couple more Grey Cups. And then Warren Moon came and was just outstanding. His first year, he and Tom Wilkinson shared the quarterback position. And then Warren got to playing full-time and of course, build his level up to where he could go to the NFL and be a star there. So the quarterbacking was, we were pretty solid there, but we had players that played week after week, didn't get injured. We had a great trainer in Jim Adams who kept them healthy and had them where they could play when they were hurt. And, you know, there are just so many players that stood out. I can say with great certainty that our team was so well balanced that we didn't end up having more than our share of players make all league teams and that kind of thing, because people couldn't really tell who the stars were from the balance in the way that we attacked on defense. And the way that we attacked on offense, everybody was involved. Our coaching staff was just really a solid coaching staff. During that six-year period, they were only voted as coach of the year one time. So there was a balance there too. And all of them went on to be head coaches and win Grey Cups at other places. And so I can't state too strongly that how great all the guys were at being team players and not worried about who gets the credit, just get the job done.
So that 81 team is one that we decided to, you know, signify, and we had a remote reunion driven by Kubota with them online. And we're talking about, obviously, as you mentioned, Warren Moon and Tom Scott catching passes, and, you know, Ed Jones defending passes, and Eric Upton keeping Warren Moon upright. Of the teams in that stretch, is that the best one? I know it's kind of like asking you to choose, you know, between your children, but in your estimation, what's the best team in that early 80s stretch?
I can't do it. I'm sorry. I just can't do it. The teams were, they faced phenomenal situations in 82. We had five injuries to our offensive players. We had five really good offensive players out. And after our Labor Day game, we lost for the first time to Calgary on Labor Day, and we were in last place. And then we won 10 straight games, that every game was a must game in order for us to get to the Grey Cup and then win the Grey Cup. And so I ended my coaching career in Canada with 10 straight wins with a team that was limping around, but just came back strong as could be and played their hearts out. So, you know, if you're going on guts alone, you might pick that team. If you're going on just skill and making it through a season with a fantastic record. Another thing that happened for, I think it was six, one, two, three, five, for five consecutive seasons, the football team won more games than they had the year before. So my first 5 years coaching, you know, the first season, we only won 10 games. This is out of 16 now. And so the next mm-hmm. year we won a little more. And then 1 year we had one tie better than we had the year before. But we went 5 years in a row with the team improving its record. That's hard to do. And so it's a matter of a team that played their hearts out every week. And we tried to win every game. Every year we had a game where the team would have the flu or something. We always talked, even in the summertime, we got to win the flu game. We talked about you're going to play on an ice game in the late season and look at the calendar and say that game in Calgary or this game in Winnipeg is going to be frozen cold. We got to win that game. So we kind of picked out a reason that we felt we had to win certain games and beat. And then when it came time and all of a sudden you were playing on a snow field, it wasn't a surprise. We remembered talking about that during training camp. So when you asked me to pick one team, I picked that team as a whole over the 6 year period. They went every way from in front or last year, where the record went down, the overall record went down. They had to put themselves in a position where they had to win every game in order to win. It was pretty exciting, but we did have a lot of good players.
You certainly did. All right, couldn't get you to choose, but I tried. And speaking of those good players, they often stayed involved in the game in various capacities and became good coaches, good executives, you know, often some had success off the field, but specifically the ones that followed in your footsteps and, you know, made an impact in the game of football in various levels and various ways. What does that mean to you to see so many guys from your program have success continually in the game much after their playing careers were done?
It means everything. It's just so key to... And it's not just people like that. You kind of referred to people that maybe were in the limelight or still in coaching that, but all of them that have gone out and whether they worked selling advertising time on radio stations or whether they worked in the media or whether they worked in the more ordinary jobs, and also building companies and all of that. And so that's what means it is the people you graduate. And not all of them ended up with you know, great successes and everything going right for them in their lives, but a high percentage did, and those people are doing their best to help out the ones that have had to struggle through the years. So I'm proud of the sport as a whole, not just our teams, but the whole league. The Canadian Football League is a bunch of athletes that were a little bit underdogs, but as a group, made a profession out of their sport and made a success and a valuable contribution in their communities.
Well, we are proud of them as well. That's why it was great for us to catch up with them as they did a reunion for us on our website. And it was great to revisit that with you here on the Waggle. Thanks so much, Hugh.
Okay, Donovan, thank you. It's fun to visit with you. And we'll look forward to talking to you again in the future.
And that's it for us this week. But the content from us here at the CFL doesn't stop. Again, Great Cup Unite. That coverage continues on our website. We've got a video essay about what the cup and the week really means to me. Got some great feedback on that from you, the fans, so thank you so much. Also, hopefully, you enjoy a conversation that I had. We did a diversity, strength, racial justice roundtable. It was a partnership between the players and the league, and so hopefully you consume that content as well, because it's probably the most important thing that I've done in a while, and it's something that we're all really, really proud of. Really, really proud of this podcast. So continue to like, favorite, listen, and subscribe. And if you liked what you heard today, make sure while you're doing all those things, go on Twitter, find @DwayneFordTSN, give him a follow as well. The most, in my opinion, authoritative voice, not the CFL, not U Sports, but Canadian football as a whole. You heard it here today. So give him a follow so you continue to get that knowledge on our game to you whenever you want it. Thanks for listening. We'll talk soon.
The WAG, presented by Sportclips, the official podcast of the Canadian Football League.